So, Lama Jinsen, perhaps you would like to lead us in the prayers. Would you like to do that, or would you?
Sure.
Okay, and so do you have the reminder for arousing bodhicitta?
I have those. But okay. I have what you gave us. Remember when we trained in our teacher thing?
Yes.
And then we do the first four prayers of this one, right?
Okay. Yes. Cheers.
Okay, so I will lead us now.
Okay, well, then I'm going to mute everybody but you. So I'm going to have to mute everybody, and then I'll unmute Lama Jinsen, and then I'll do the meditation. Lama Jinsen asked me to lead the meditation, and then we'll launch into the class. So now muting everybody. You're all muted, and I'm unmuting Lama Jinsen, and she's unmuted, and I'm going to mute myself so we don't have a train wreck of two audio inputs at the same time.
In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfume and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon. This imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And this is me doing the four dharmas of Gampopa. So, Dakta sem chen tam che lo ju su jo or sen ji lap tu so, chu lam tu jo or sen ji lap tu so, mam ju or su or sen ji lap tu so, chu pa ye she su jo or sen ji lap tu so. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the mind of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration of excellent conduct. Flai ke dang lu dang nu jin ke chu pun ta ta mi e ke nan dang jo wa kun ji jo ke ji san par tam che ke du da ki chu ten do. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And so now we should all aspire towards bodhicitta, the attitude where we give rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation.
Okay, I'm now unmuted. And I will do the meditation. Anybody have any questions, need anything before we do our meditation? Okay, we're going to do about 10 minutes of meditation today. And we do, and this is another handout that I'll send people who are with us for the first time today. We do a sheet called The Two Wings of Awakening that we use in the Tuesday night class at KTC. It consists of basically the first two points of the 7 points of mind training, which are the practice of ultimate and relative bodhicitta. So we'll start by checking in with our posture. We all know the posture points, and the main point is just to have the spine straight, but as Kala Rinpoche puts it, not militaristic. Just straight and relaxed. Helps the energy flow so that the mind settles easily. And let's just take a moment to let our mind come to rest a bit from the busyness of our thoughts and of getting here, getting everything together to be here today. just let our awareness, our attention settle into awareness of our body, how our body feels in this, on the seat, in this space, in this present moment of awareness. And within this state of resting, we will contemplate the four reminders. We're going to do the classic English translation of the classic way it's expressed in the Nundro practices. First, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make it meaningful. Kala Rinpoche called these the four basic advices. Secondly, everything is impermanent, the world and all it contains. In particular, the life of beings is as fragile as a bubble of water. The time of death is uncertain, and when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Thirdly, at the time of death, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must therefore refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day monitor my stream of being. And fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of existence continually torment me through the three types of suffering. They are like the last meal before my execution. I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish awakening. So we will request the blessing of the Lama. So you can visualize your root Lama on a lotus and moon seat in a body of light above the crown of your head. If you're more comfortable, you can visualize the Buddha or a deity of your choice. Requesting their blessing that we may develop the same level of realization of love, compassion, and bodhicitta that they have. So we visualize them above the crown of our head. With or without words, we request that blessing. And they grant it just because we asked. And receiving the blessing, we allow the visualization to descend from the crown of our head through the top of our head into our heart center, and thenceforth the Lama or the Buddha or the deity is in our heart center, but we don't need to think about it any longer. So we're continuously receiving their blessing, and we'll do a few rounds of just following the breath or resting in open awareness, just to bring our minds more to rest. And letting go of any object we may be using for bringing our mind to rest, we just open our awareness, first becoming aware of, if our eyes are open, becoming aware of light and color that we can see. Just being receptive to it, not thinking about it. And while maintaining that awareness, we also open our awareness to sound. Any sounds that we may be hearing, we're receptive to those. Just letting them pass in and out of our awareness. Becoming receptive to any tactile sensations we may be feeling, the temperature of the room, any air movement, any internal sensations, any discomfort, any tension. Just noticing without losing track of visual and auditory senses. So all of our senses open. We also open our awareness of our thoughts and emotions, like what is our mental state right now? And we're just noticing it. We're not delving into it or questioning it or creating a storyline, just noticing how we're feeling, both in our body and in our mind and emotions. And as Pema Chodron advises, we're, however we may be feeling mentally or emotionally, we notice it with love and acceptance, with compassion, knowing that it's fine. Even if it doesn't feel fine, on some level, it's fine, and we rest with it like that. So within this state of relaxation, of open awareness, we follow the steps of cultivating ultimate bodhicitta from the seven points of mind training by first looking at whatever we're experiencing as a dream, as if it could be a dream, as if it's not as solid as it might seem. Stepping back from our thoughts, opinions, judgments, emotional reactions, perception of solidity. It could be a dream and we could wake up. And at the very least, it's just a fleeting experience. And then we turn our attention in step two to examine the nature of unborn awareness, which means we turn our attention to look at the mind itself, which is experiencing everything as a dream. And we could ask ourselves, with or without words, any kind of a question to sort of bring ourselves into sync with the mind itself, whether it has color, shape, whether it has a location. And we don't analyze the question or the answer. We just ask the question and rest in not being able to say, as Ken MacLeod says. Step three is to let even the remedy release naturally, which means whatever conclusion we may have come to about what the mind is, we let that go. And that brings us to just resting without any concepts, without any thoughts, although thoughts can come and go. So that's step four, rest in the essence, the basis of everything. So at this point, we are resting in the nature of a mind, whether we feel like we recognize it or not, just not grasping onto or fixating on any thoughts that may come and go, just resting in the flow of experience. So now, without losing track of ultimate bodhicitta, of resting in the nature of mind, keeping that awareness open, we cultivate relative bodhicitta by practicing taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. We all know how to do that, the basic technique, and we're going to follow, you know, in keeping with Pema Chodron's teachings that we studied in the first two classes. We're going to start by just checking in again with ourselves, our own like emotional reality of the moment or physical reality of the moment. How's everything feeling? And if there's anything that feels uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful, either physically or emotionally, we breathe that in. We let it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature as our breath dissolves. And we breathe out to ourself whatever we need. We breathe out healing, happiness, peace, anything we need. Knowing that within our Buddha nature, our resources are inexhaustible. So we'll continue tonglen for ourselves just for a few rounds. Breathing in anything distressing or uncomfortable, breathing out okayness. And now we'll include any beings, whether we know them or not, who may be having the same kind of discomfort in this moment, breathing in all of their distress or discomfort, letting it dissolve, breathing out whatever's needed. Knowing that whatever unpleasantness we may be dealing with, there are many, many beings dealing with the same thing. And now including all sentient beings, breathing in the suffering of all beings in all six realms of existence, letting it dissolve and breathing out healing, happiness, peace, everything good. If any specific beings come to mind, then include them specifically. Anyone you're particularly concerned for in this moment, breathe in their suffering. And now thinking that through this practice, all beings, including ourselves, are completely free from suffering, completely filled with happiness, and completely awakened. And we'll take a moment to rejoice in that. And then come back to just open awareness, letting go of all visualization, all concepts. Just resting in open awareness with all our senses open. Very relaxed, but alert. And now coming back at your own speed to study and contemplation mode. So I've unmuted Lama Jinzong. I'm going to quickly recap what we talked about last week, just to set the stage for Lama Jinzong's explanation of Buddha nature. So what I'm going to do is, I'm actually just going to read, because it's very short, read the introduction to Gampopa's own introduction to the Ornament of Precious Liberation. Generally speaking, all phenomena can be categorized as either samsara or nirvana. Remember that because it's going to come up in Buddha nature. All phenomena are either samsara or nirvana. There's nothing in between. With regard to samsara, its nature is emptiness. It manifests as confusion, and it is characterized by suffering. With regard to nirvana, its nature is also emptiness. It manifests as the exhaustion and disappearance of all confusion, and it is characterized by freedom from suffering. So if we're ever in doubt as to whether we are in samsara or nirvana, just check and see if we have any suffering, any discomfort. If we do, we're in samsara. So Gampopa poses a series of questions to clarify what we're up against here as samsaric beings. Who is confused in samsara? All sentient beings of the three realms. What is the basis of confusion? Confusion is projected onto emptiness. Remember, emptiness is the basis of everything. So if you're in samsara, you're projecting confusion onto emptiness. If you're in nirvana, you're not projecting, and you're just seeing everything as empty. What is the cause of confusion? Fundamental ignorance. How does confusion manifest as the experiences of the six types of beings? Is there a metaphor to describe confusion? It is like sleep and dreams. When did confusion begin? There has been confusion since beginningless time. What's the problem with being confused? All experience is suffering. When will confusion transform into wisdom? Not until unsurpassable awakening is attained. So now we have the prospect of there is like an alternative. There is an antidote to suffering, and that is to be completely awake. But Gompopa is now going to give us the bad news that it's not going to happen without effort on our part. So this is kind of the crux of the introduction, and this is the compelling case for following the path. He says, for anyone who thinks confusion may clear up by itself, samsara is well known to be endless. So in light of the reality that samsara is nothing but confusion, how much suffering it involves, how long it lasts, and that it will never liberate itself, from this day forward, we must make every effort to attain unsurpassable awakening. So what do we have to do? He finishes up by telling us what we have to do, and that's the whole book. What does this effort require? Those with discernment will come to know unsurpassable awakening through six topics, summarized as cause, support, condition, method, result, and activity. And if you have the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, also known as Ornament of Precious Liberation, then you just look at the introduction and you can read all of this anytime. You can review it anytime. So of these six topics, the first three, cause, support, and condition, those are the three prerequisites that we need to have in place before we can effectively follow the path. The method is almost the whole book. That's the teachings. That's the how-to of how to get from samsara to nirvana. And then the last two chapters are the result, which is Buddhahood. Like if we follow all the steps, we get to Buddhahood. And then the last chapter is, if we get to Buddhahood, what do we do? That's the activity of Buddha. So that's the basic framework of Ornament of Precious Liberation. And today we are on topic number one, which is just one chapter of the book, Buddha Nature, and I'm going to hand it over to Lama Jinzong now.
So I'm going to be primarily working with this book, The Path to Buddhahood by Ringo Tuchel, and also primarily then fleshing out parts that are missing with the Ornament of Precious Liberation. This, and I'll give page numbers, so if people want to be following. Can you all hear me? I tend to talk softer when I'm... Okay. So beginning with the Ringo Tuchel book, page 7. So he says, the first factor is the jhut, and this is the Tibetan term often known as like continuum, something that continues. And here he's saying, he also says, which literally translates literally as cause. So in this context, it has three meanings: primary cause, seed, and nature. This is the Buddha nature that is inherent in everyone. It is what gives us the possibility of getting out of samsara and attaining enlightenment or nirvana. We should, however, understand that this is just a way of speaking. Samsara and nirvana are not two separate places or locations. One does not leave the one to enter the other. This is one of the most important and basic principles of Buddhism. Once in nirvana, one never returns to samsara, because nirvana is not some destination to be reached, but an understanding of the true nature of samsara. It is a permanent state because it means understanding and total wisdom. What we call samsara is our state of confusion and suffering. To understand the true nature of the suffering implies an understanding of how things truly are. As the confusion disappears, so does the suffering. That is nirvana. As it is said in the beginning, the basic nature of samsara and nirvana are the same. They are both what we call shunyata, or emptiness. And so I'd like just to refer back to what we were doing in the first two classes. Some of you who weren't here, a brief understanding was a discussion by that Chidran introduced by Pema Chödrön, what's her last name?
Yeah, Pema Chödrön.
Oh, Pema Chödrön. That's why I was like, hello,
Pema. Pema Chödrön.
Right. And in a course that Chödrön, our Lama Chödrön, took, based on the six realms of samsara, but the point being that the realms are referring to psychological states of mind. So here too, what's being pointed out is that when it says nirvana and samsara are not actual places, it's like I remember years ago, Kenpo Soltram, Jamso Rinpoche saying, Devachan is just right where you are. So it's got to do with a recognition of the true nature of reality, of both external and internal experience of all phenomena, that ultimately we're describing different states of awareness, different states of realization, which refers to the different ways in which we relate to our own perception, the different way we actually interpret our own perceptions. So whether we are actually attaching reality or solidity to what appears to us, all forms of the senses, or you know, whatever forms these manifestations take, whether they're of the six senses, the five, you know, taste, touch, tactile, well, I guess that's the same, but you know, smell, etc., all those senses, plus mental experience, all of that, whether you solidify it and think incorrectly or incorrectly that these actually refer to something that truly exists from their own side as substantial material stuff from their own side, independent of our experience of them, or the experience of the state of nirvana in which you recognized beyond any intellectual thought process, but you're already in a sustained realization that everything is just mere appearance, independent, or as it's been said by Ari Goldfeder, he would say it's mere interdependent appearance. So it's just mere appearance, completely coming together due to causes and conditions, that once those causes and conditions dissolve, they come apart, then you no longer experience that phenomena. So I probably am fairly long-winded here, but all I'm trying to say is that then everything is empty, as it says, both our experience of what is called samsara and nirvana, everything is empty of substantiality, but everything completely arises. There's no reason for anything not to arise because there's nothing that keeps it from arising. It's arising within the phenomena of emptiness. And so whether you assign solidity and attribute a true reality to what you're experiencing, that's the state of samsara. And when you recognize that it's mere appearance, and let go of any kind of solidity to your experience. Again, it's a non-conceptual one. That is the state of nirvana. So going now back into, is that clear from people? Is that all clear?
Okay. I thought that was very well said. Thank you very much.
Okay. So now we're into, again, page 8 of Ringu Toku's text, where the large print says Buddha nature. And it says, this seed refers to our Buddha nature. So again, we're talking about cause. The cause is Buddha nature, to the question being, why is it that we can even think we could become Buddhas? And the answer is that within us already, we can attain enlightenment because we already possess the nature of a Buddha. All living beings have this Buddha nature. One might wonder how we know this. And traditionally, we are presented with three distinct types of evidence. So within Buddhist philosophy, there are three types of evidence or three types of proofs that are given. One is scriptural, one is logical, and one is empirical. And for this first one, scriptural, one has to assume that you're already believing in the concept of Buddhahood because it's based on the actual words of the Buddha. So basically it's saying because the Buddha says so, and I can then find different, quotes, then that's proof because the Buddha himself said so. So you just have to accept that this is a form of evidence within the Buddhist construct called scriptural authority. So it says, Buddha Shakyamuni himself asserted the presence of Buddha nature, and we have every reason to trust what he said, as he himself attained Buddhahood. Who better to tell us whether Buddha nature exists or not? In the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the Buddha says, the essence of Buddhahood pervades all beings. Likewise, the Maha Parinirvana Sutra says, all beings possess the nature of Buddha, or synonymous with that is Tathagata Garbha, that's Sanskrit. This same sutra goes on to explain that Buddha nature is inherent in all beings as butter is inherent in milk. This assertion was not only made by Buddha himself, but also by his successors, particularly those who founded and developed Mahayana Buddhism, such as Asanga and Nagarjuna. So basically, the point here is that because the Buddha said so, and various great masters who attained the same state of realization spoke in this way, then we trust that it's true. Okay, everyone okay with that? Okay, so now we're on to the second. I'm just referring to page 16 now in Ornament of Precious Liberation, the hardcovered book, that just so you can hear it from the text, it says to explain the first reason. Dharmakaya, emptiness, pervades all beings. So here the Buddha is embodied in the Dharmakaya. So we know, or may not know, but I'm assuming you all know, that when we talk of Buddhahood, we speak of three kayas. The first is the benefit to oneself, which is the realization known as Dharmakaya, recognizing the empty aspect of all phenomena. And in that understanding, we recognize that emptiness pervades all beings, in that there is no single phenomena, all beings included within phenomena, that are not empty by their nature. They appear, but they are not substantially. It's a coarse appearance. And here the Buddha is embodied in the Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya is emptiness. So since it says emptiness is something pervading all sentient beings, it follows that all beings have the essence of Buddhahood. So you sort of have to just, that little equation there, just you look at it, but ultimately it's saying that, and now I'm going back to the Ringo Tolku book. So we're now back in page 8, where it says the beginning of the last paragraph, the second way to demonstrate the existence of Buddha nature. And this is now talking about logical proof. So in a certain way, the first and the second proof are sort of combined in his text, because he's saying the first way, and he's sort of including the first proof that was provided Gumbopa, and then he goes on to the second, but I'm getting you confused. So let's just forget about numbers and read from the Ringo Tunko text. It says, the second way to demonstrate the existence of Buddha nature consists rather in describing precisely what Buddha nature is, and then determining if and how it manifests in being. The nature of both samsara and nirvana is shunyata, and from now on, it's emptiness, so I'll just keep saying emptiness. Therefore, the basic nature of all beings is also emptiness. So like Chidrin was reading in the beginning where it says, all there is samsara and nirvana. As she said, if you have suffering, you're in samsara. If you don't, you're in nirvana. But all phenomena are included in that. And that is also the nature of shunyata, or emptiness. So therefore, the basic nature of all beings is also shunyata, or emptiness. This is synonymous with the term Dharmakaya. In Buddhism, there is much talk of the three kayas, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. These ideas are not the most easily accessible at first, but they will be explained in more details in later chapters. Dharmakaya has many different meanings, but here I use the term to describe the true ultimate nature of phenomena. In this context, the word dharma signifies true appearance or true nature, while kaya means form. Dharmakaya means, therefore, the form of the true nature or ultimate reality. Whether one is in samsara or nirvana, our true nature can be nothing other than this ultimate truth or Dharmakaya. If we understand, experience, and realize this ultimate nature, this fundamental truth, we attain, indeed we become, the Dharmakaya. So now in this text is where we begin with the second logical reasoning. And so I refer to page 16 if you want to look at it, where I left off in the hardcover text. It says, the second reason, it says, the universal essence, suchness, is without differentiation. And this means that whether it is in terms of good and bad, great and small, or higher and lower, there is no difference between the universal essence in Buddhas and the universal essence in sentient beings. Thus, sentient beings possess the Buddha essence. So now I come back to page 9, where we left off in Rinku Tukul, and his commentary on this. Oh, sorry, it's star gas. I'm really sorry. You want to mute me for a second?
Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to, I have to mute Jinzong. Yes, John.
Okay, I thought I had a good grasp on causes and conditions, but started thinking more about it and it seemed to get more confused, so to speak. And I was wondering, is there a background where these causes and conditions happen? But I suppose that's Dharmakaya, which is emptiness. So I guess I'm answering the question, but something can happen in if it's empty, because it really didn't happen, but we think it happens.
Yeah.
So
well said, John. Well said.
Oh.
Yes, Dharmakaya is emptiness. It's the potential for anything to arise. So all causes and conditions come out of this infinite potential for anything to arise. At the Dharmakaya level, nothing is manifested. When it manifests, then it becomes at the form level. So it becomes appearances as opposed to ultimate reality. Does that clarify anything at all?
Oh, yeah, that's what I was...
Yeah, I think you got it, though. You basically got it. You
it
said
seems it. Seems like the conclusion I came to. And then another tangent was, well, in a dream, the foundation of that is thoughts, is it not?
Yes.
And I guess thoughts are empty as well. So
yes,
back there's the circle.
Yes, dreams are empty. And so when we cultivate ultimate bodhicitta by seeing all experience as like a dream, we're just taking it back to that level.
Okay.
Anything further?
Thanks.
I'm unmuting.
Thanks.
Okay. Lama Jinzong is back. Yes, Lama Jinzong is back. We had a little conversation with John and he solved his own question. And
okay.
So now we're back to wherever you would like to take us.
Yeah, okay. I'm so sorry. That's Stargast. The women's retreat needed something and I knew they would come at exactly.
Yes.
Okay. So
that's all right.
So now we're back to the second reason of why Buddha nature, all sentient beings possess the Buddha essence. And I'm back to page 9 in Rinku Tukul. The true nature, the Dharmakaya, does not change because it's empty. So there is nothing material about it to change. There's no substance that can grow old or age. And in that sense, there's no substance that comes into being in the beginning, which is why you say it's beginningless, because it's not a thing that came into being and it's not a thing that will go out to being, will have duration. It is changeless in its nature because there is nothing of it to be changed. So it says nothing has ever altered it. Whether one is a samsaric being or an enlightened being, the Dharmakaya isn't any smaller or worse in the former, or any bigger or better in the latter. A Buddha and an ordinary being have exactly the same basic nature. Attaining Buddhahood does not mean we become someone completely different. Rather, we become fully conscious of what we have always been. It isn't something that descends upon us, but rather it is an understanding, a realization. Our confusion disappears. We can compare samsara to a thick fog that prevents us from seeing anything except as vague and confused shapes. When the mist clears, the landscape hasn't changed, but now we see it clearly. So again, this thick fog is our own conceptuality, which is misperception of what arises, where we impute reality, substantiality to our experience, not recognizing that although everything appears as it does in a dream, which is that we experience everything, but there's no actual substantial stuff. A dream fire cannot burn us because a dream fire has no true qualities of hot and burning, and therefore we can't be harmed by it. So this is why it's now saying that therefore what's happening is it's not that we're creating anything. We're simply, the veils of conceptuality are peeled away, are removed, and we're able to see clearly. We're able to understand things as they actually are. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now we come into the third. And the third is, and I'm just reading from the text of empirical, I'm still going in this text. Okay, it says, finally, so I'm in Rinkotoku still. Finally, although we are in samsara, we can see the proof of the existence of Buddha nature permeating all beings. This third way in which we can discern whether beings have Buddha nature is rik, determine, that's the Tibetan term. In other words, the quality we perceive in one who possesses the Buddha nature. So now we're into the third form of logic, which is empirical. So first was scriptural, the second was logical, and now we're into empirical logic. Rik is a word that is difficult to translate. Literally, it means cast. Gunther, who's the original, I believe the first one to translate this text into English, translates it as family, but it's not quite like that. It means something more like a tribal gene. For example, Europeans often have fair hair and blue eyes. Orientals have black hair and eyes. This is due to rik. All beings have Buddha nature because all beings have within themselves what we call the essence of the Buddha, this Jew, this seed, which can blossom into a Buddha and which constitutes our potential for enlightenment. But what is a Buddha? Briefly, a Buddha is one who has developed his or her compassion and wisdom to the ultimate level, beyond all limits. Wisdom in this context refers not to an accumulation of knowledge, but to the ability to see the true nature of all things. What characterizes a Buddha, therefore, is wisdom and compassion. To determine whether Buddha nature exists in all beings, we need to examine whether they possess the qualities of wisdom and compassion. Without wisdom and compassion, it is impossible to become a Buddha. But if one possesses even an embryonic amount of these qualities, one can then develop them to their ultimate level and become Buddha. The most concrete proof of the presence of this nature is that we possess, to varying degrees, these qualities of wisdom and compassion. According to Buddhism, there is no being, human or otherwise, who doesn't possess some wisdom and compassion. However bad, however evil, every being has some minimal amount of love, kindness, or compassion, at least for themselves or for one other being. Similarly, all of us have some understanding, instinctual or otherwise, of what is right or wrong. These two qualities, kindness and understanding of right from wrong, however small or insignificant they are present in every living being. As these two qualities can potentially be developed to their ultimate level, it can be said that all beings have Buddha nature. We can therefore all be said to be little Buddhas. So now we begin with what Gampopa describes as the qualities visible in Buddha nature, and he describes them within five categories. And so I just would, five groups, read this. Now we're back to page 16 in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, the hard-covered book, K.
Can I just interject one thing here? Yes. Which is that I think for me, the easiest way to understand these five categories or these five stages is that they are degrees of separation from your Buddha nature or closeness to your Buddha nature, like the degree to which Buddha nature is expressed or realized in you. So starting with the least and moving toward the most. Yeah. So anyway, I think of it as 5 degrees of separation from Buddha nature.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I had a conversation with Trigun last night, actually, because we're beginning. So anyway, let me just say that I'm just going to read the bold print here, and then we'll go back to Rinko Toku. But so it says on page 16, those with enlightenment potential can be summed up as belonging to 5 groups. Those with severed potential, undetermined potential, Shravyaka, or in this case, it's hearers. It's often translated as hearers' potential, Pratyaka Buddha potentials, or those of the self-realizers, and those with the Mahayana potential. So now I'm going to return to Rinko Toku's text, or again in page 10, the beginning of the last paragraph. And it says, the first stage is called Ricce, which literally means cut off from the caste or family. So it was translated as the severed potential, which is kind of a Halloween sort of ghoulish kind of way of thinking of it, the severed potential. So anyway, it just means that this he describes the state of those whose Buddha nature is not apparent. Okay, that's less ghoulish in my mind, that it's they're not apparent. They can be recognized by 6 signs. They feel no sorrow in the face of the shortcomings of samsara and no desire for liberation. Even when they experience intense suffering, they don't recognize the causes. They don't even see that there is a problem. They feel no confidence or trust when they hear about the qualities of the Buddhas and the states superior to samsara. They feel no culpability when they harm others. The whole world can criticize them, but they feel no shame. They never feel the slightest remorse, nor the slightest compassion. The beings who present these signs belong to the family of those with switched off potential. So that's what he refers to it as, switched off, not severed. Which speaks to what Chodron is saying, which is that it's degrees of manifestation. So in this case, it's merely switched off. They appear not to have the required qualities, and they live as if they didn't possess Buddha nature. This does not mean, however, that they will never become Buddhas, but it does mean that it will take them a long time. So I was talking to children last night, because if earlier it says the most concrete proof of the presence of the nature is that we possess to various degrees qualities of wisdom and compassion, how do you think about all of the, you know, severely, you know, in this day and age, we're so aware of like the vast number of the psychopaths and sociopaths who seem to have no feeling for other human beings, that they just can not only and it says that at some degree everyone has some sense of right and wrong. Like, how do you work with that? How does that, you know, I couldn't really think about it, but now I started thinking that, you know, even in these terrible cases where these people arbitrarily just kill unknown people, but then they kill themselves. So at some level, they, you know, I think, do they know that at some level they've done something wrong, which is why they then take themselves out? Or also how this idea that Buddhism in general teaches people that if nothing else, I am so sorry. Oh my God. Hello?
Sorry about that. Just going on and on. Hopefully everybody's just meditating right now, which is what we do when we have like nothing happening. So does anybody have any questions or comments at this point? And if not, then this is a meditation gap here. And we could just let our minds come to rest for a moment or process what we're studying. Marilyn, you're unmuted.
I was reminded somehow or other of when Lama was here, Lama Norla was here not long after 9/11, and his first reaction was, think of the incredible suffering of those people who diverted the planes and crashed them. And so I think it meant he knew there was something there and he felt sorrow for them because they did have Buddha nature and that they sort of wrecked it. But he was relating to them on that level as opposed to going for anger and, you know, all sorts of other reactions that you could have. So to me, that was his recognition of that kind of basic nature despite all circumstances seeming to counteract that.
Yeah. Yeah, they just put a huge obstacle between themselves and realizing their Buddha nature. You know, when we engage in negative karma, we're distancing ourselves from our Buddha nature. So thank you. Yeah. Yes, I remember he taught in New Hampshire as well right after 9/11. And he said something like that, and some people got up and laughed. It was a public talk. They were very upset.
Well, I had the experience of being asked to speak after 9/11 at UMBC where I taught, and they chose me.
Okay, so what you need
to... Whoops. They chose me because I was a Buddhist. And when I think people were sort of shocked when I brought up what the Dalai Lama said about violence does not end violence. It's not an appropriate reaction. I got a lot of people who sort of didn't believe me when I said that, but it's sort of the same thing.
Yeah. I think it's really helpful. I mean, I think that was a great gift of Rinpoche, like to make out of that terrible situation is to be reminded that everybody does have Buddha nature. And if we can remember that, it helps us relate with compassion to people who are doing really heinous things. So Lama Jinsang is back. You're now unmuted, Lama. And I just want to point out, Lama Jinsang has been with us week after week after week, and she's never had an interruption until today.
And it's all because the star guest, I got a note from Niggling, the women's retreat, saying they need all their heat turned on. And star guest, I knew it. They wouldn't give me a time. And John Jin's blah, blah, blah. Okay. Anyway.
Okay.
All right. I'm so sorry. So I don't know what questions I hear you've been talking, but I just wanted to say that for me, this idea was that, you know, that no matter how heinous, I heard you say that word, if that's the right pronunciation, is that nobody likes to suffer. We know that clearly. And everyone wants happiness. And so even the most horrific people, we see clearly that at some level, you know, I don't even know how to say this, but, you know, that at some level, even these people who act so horribly, that somewhere in their own life, if nothing else, they act in a way that they try to make themselves happy, as sick as it may sound. You know, there are sadists who like, or people who like, I'm so used to self-degrading myself that it's my habit. I'm comfortable with it. I'm comfortable with feeling bad about myself. But in my own way, the point is that makes me feel good, or I think I'm acting in a way that's helping me feel like in my comfort zone, if nothing else. And so that even though people are externally and just horrifically, at some level, they have some sense of what makes them feel good and not wanting to self-harm themselves. Because if they just wanted to self-harm them, they would just, you know, anyway, I don't know. These were my ways of trying to understand these two seemingly disparate things that everyone knows a sense of right and wrong, and then we see such horrific activity. Chidrin, did you have something to offer? Were you talking about this while I missed it? Or
Well, we had a couple of questions, and Marilyn in particular was talking about when right after 9/11, when Rinpoche spoke in D.C., saying we should have compassion for the perpetrators. Which is a very difficult concept for some people, because it is hard, as you're saying, to understand that. Like, how could Hitler have Buddha nature, for example?
You know, to speak to that, interestingly enough, having grown up Jewish, and the reason I don't even shave my head is because my family has always seen it, a shaved head is equated with a concentration camp. So they've always been grateful to me. And Lama Norla Rinpoche always said, it's just hair. You know, I'd be like, oh God, I feel like I don't know who I am. And he's like, just, you know, shut up. It's just hair. And the most important thing is not to plant a negative seed of Dharma. And if you're in the mind of your family, they see a shaved head as a negative thing, you can't do it. And they have several times over the many years said, I'm glad you don't shave your head. So, but the idea that with, you know, what is the story about like Hitler? And we see like, oh my God, these like zillions of innocent people, not just Jews, but Poles, you know, everybody, you know, all in any form of genocide, which is continuing to this day. If we only see it as this life, then we see it as these poor people who did nothing to deserve what's happened to them. And we see these horrific, you know, dictator, just, you know, horrific beings that have this power over others to take life in that monumental way. And Rinpoche would say, you know, this is where karma comes in, and a belief that there's previous lives and that not everything is dependent on this single life. And if you have a...
I think it's going to be a theme today of all days. So did anybody have anything to say about this topic? Any thoughts on this topic? Maria, did you have something to say?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, yes. I've unmuted you.
I'm not sure exactly how to say it, but I'm just responding to this whole thing about karma.
Yeah.
And the one thing I have found that's caused a lot of resistance in non-Buddhists especially, maybe even in some Buddhists, is that karma is often seen in the Christian context of guilt and blame. I don't think there's guilt or blame in Buddhism. Yeah. I think it's just causes and conditions that lead to results. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, guilt and blame are not considered like a way to help yourself wake up,
right,
which is what it all comes down to, is how do we wake ourselves up and how do we see things from a viewpoint of wisdom and compassion? Guilt and blame are big sort of distractions or deviations from, you know, from that.
How do you prevent karma being used as a way to say you deserve that?
Well, you don't. People will, you know, I mean, we can't control what people think or say, really, but we can know. And
I've seen a lot of Buddhists say, this is karma, and they're saying it in the way you deserve that.
Yeah.
You know, karma's a bitch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well,
as Buddhists, we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't use karma against somebody to make somebody feel bad or guilty or to one-up them or whatever.
It's not in line with compassion.
Yeah, it's not in line with compassion, exactly. We're always asking, what's the compassionate response? And, you know, back to the topic at hand, is that to have the compassionate response, it really helps to recognize the Buddha nature of the person. Like, you're talking to a Buddha. We're always talking to a Buddha or a potential Buddha. So we don't want to do anything that's going to put them in a negative state of mind or put ourselves in a negative state of mind. We always try to deal with things in a positive way, even when we're having to come down. Sometimes we do have to come down on somebody to stop something that's hurting someone. But we can always do that with compassion and with recognition. I mean, that's the beauty of this chapter, really, and the beauty of these five, you know, stages or degrees of potential, is that you can look at somebody who's doing something harmful and just think they're not acting in accordance with their Buddha nature right now, but this doesn't mean that they have it. They're cut off right in this moment from their connection with their Buddha nature because they're acting in a way that's harming someone. But in terms of the bigger question that you're asking of, you know, how to look at karma, how to prevent karma from being used sort of in a negative non-Buddhist way, well, you know, we have no control. But we can just know ourselves that that's not a helpful way to look at it, so then we don't pile on. We would never do that. Say, oh, you deserve that. That's your karma.
Good.
Well, so something bad's going to happen to you.
Because people, some have said, well, that's your interpretation. That's not the Buddhist interpretation.
Yeah.
Buddhist is very clearly pointing out to the fact that you deserve this. And so that is not the intention.
It's not the intention. It is the fact in the end, but it's not up to us to know, like, what kind of karma someone else is incurring. We don't know.
Right.
That's we really don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Joanne and then John.
Lama?
Yes,
In reference to karma, Gampopa himself lost his wife to the plague.
Right.
As a physician, he tried desperately to save her life. And in the Life of Gampopa by Jampa Stewart, he mentions in quotes that Gampopa attributed her suffering to bad karma.
Right.
And again, that was hard for me to reconcile, that he was very blunt about it.
Yeah.
He was compassionate, but very blunt. And anyway, that's my thought. And again, this was very beneficial. Yes, I think we need to refrain from being judgmental. I think that ultimately is remaining impartial. And again, that aspect of positivity is very important.
Yeah. I think with regard to karma, like the use of the concept of karma, it's really not about beating other people up, but we can use it ourselves when we're suffering. It can help us immensely. And I've seen this again and again. If you just remember, I must have done something, like there must be some karmic reason for this to happen to me, instead of just thinking the universe is extremely unfair. But yeah, John, so Lama Jinzang, we have a couple of questions or comments, and then we can resume. We have John, and then we have Valerie. So John?
Okay, so karma, as you said, we can't know what someone else's karma was that got, or is, but we can know that their acts are not, or are negative acts and will affect their future karma, and we can have compassion for that.
Yeah. I think that's a good observation. I think sometimes we can't, though. Sometimes it looks like people are doing something bad and we're misinterpreting what they're doing. I mean, there's just so many ways that you can go wrong with this. But generally, yes, if you see someone doing something that's clearly a negative action that's harming someone, then yes, you can know that there's going to be a karmic result from that. Is that it, John?
Yeah, just saying okay. That we can have compassion for that.
Yes, yes. Okay, so we got Valerie, and then we have Marilyn. You're unmuted, Valerie. And Lama Jinzang, please feel free to do the answering.
I've been thinking about karma in terms of people who, my friend who's suffering terrible with cancer. Sometimes my thinking is that you will only understand something going through that way. It's not a matter of that, that you deserve it or anything like that. It's just the only way you're going to realize whatever. And I'm not talking about just bad, deliberate bad acts, but people are just like so blameless.
Yeah. Okay, so that was...
That's what makes sense,
Yeah, thank you, Valerie. So we got Marilyn, and then I think Anne had her hand up.
I'd just like you to see this wonderful book by Trungpa Rinpoche called Karma, What It Is and What It Isn't. It's a really good book.
Yeah. Yes, it's the best explanation of karma I've ever seen. It's a fabulous book.
Who wrote that?
It's a little technical. It's Trungpa Rinpoche.
Can you see this? Traleg Chabjong Rinpoche. But if you Google karma, what it is and what it isn't and why it matters, you'll get it.
Okay, thank you, Marilyn. And I think Anne had her hand up. Anne?
Well, I'd just like to throw in that Lama Norla used to always say, we go up, we go down, and it's just the accumulation of over eons, and we all go through it, and we all have good times, and we all have really bad times, and it's sort of, so if one person is suffering something horrible, they're no different than any of us. We're all going to go up and down if you subscribe to the philosophy, you know. It's not every, all of us.
Yes, thank you. And so it becomes very hard to judge people.
Right.
In a way. So it is good to remember everybody has Buddha nature, whatever they may be doing, and everybody's going to have karma to deal with, whatever we all may be doing. So we just watch our own behavior is the best thing, I think. So Lama Jinzong, I think you're on again.
Okay, I'm so sorry about that, about this situation. So
I think the universe is having fun with you today.
Yeah, I actually had to run down to the retreat and let the guy in. I'm like, whatever. Okay.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. But I've certainly introduced a little bit, you know, of karma, I realize. But I had to because even though, you know, it's just, this has been sort of a little problem for me because, again, if they're cut off, then, you know, how can you say in the previous paragraph that, you know, everyone has some sense of right or wrong? So that's why I ended up bringing it up. So,
yeah. And it led to a good discussion.
Yeah.
Well, in your absence.
Okay. okay. So, yeah, that's what I was saying is that just to finish my thought was that, you know, recognizing that even though, you know, that well, let's put it this way. The reason I believe in karma was because it's like, what I had so much trouble was before I came to Dharma was like, it seemed like there was such just insane amounts of injustice in the world. And if you're born a Kennedy and all there is one life and you're like royalty. And then if you're born someone of much lesser caste, as it were, then, you know, your life is S-H-I-T. And like, it was like, then there is no justice. And the notion of being just, the notion that there's fairness in my sense was like, there is no fairness if there's only one life. How could we even have any kind of connection to the notion of the idea? How could that even resonate with us if we have one life and we're seeing nothing that's fair around us? And that was part of what got me to how karma helped. And I think that that's an interesting point here about knowing good and bad is that at some level, the fact that we even have a sense of something being just or unjust, where does that come from? You know? So, you know, I took that to mean here too, that, you know, these are the signs of certain qualities and somehow trusting in those qualities. It means that there's something beyond what our experience of our phenomenal world is that we have, you know, that we have within us. So I sort of moved on from that. Okay, so now we're into the second stage. So we're on page 11 of Ringo Toku. And so this is what was being called in Gompopa's or translation as the undetermined potential. He says the second stage groups, those whose situation is not definite. Their Buddha nature manifests according to the circumstances. When they are under a good influence or in a good frame of mind, then their Buddha nature can be seen. And when the same people are in a bad mood or in bad company, then they show no compassion or kindness, and their Buddha nature seems to disappear. This to me is very, you know, you might as well say if you woke up on the good side of the bed, you're like things are good and you're nice, and if you woke up crabby or cranky, you know, it's hard to remember your, you know, that, you know, other people are, you know, you're just, you know, you are projecting your own bad mood onto other people.
So anyway, I call this one wishy-washy potential.
Oh, wishy-washy potential. Fair enough.
Whichever way the wind blows. Yeah. That way.
Okay. So now we're into the third. And this one is what it says, the third stage is that of the Shravakas. And so that's the hearers. And he's very brief in this text. He just says, they recognize that samsara offers nothing but problems and unhappiness and have resolved to leave it all behind. They tend to focus their efforts on attaining nirvana by concentrating on developing their wisdom, but not their compassion. And I'd like us just to turn, if you have the text, because it's a little more fleshed out. In the hardcover OPL, which actually, if you have the jewel ornament, I wrote down that it's I don't know. I thought I wrote it down. Maybe it's page 53 or something. But in any way, it just says, it's the bottom of page 17 in the hardcover. And it says, those with the Shravaka or hero potential fear samsara, believe in nirvana, and have limited compassion. The scriptures say, seeing the sufferings of nirvana, they are afraid. They manifestly aspire for nirvana. They are not interested in working for the welfare of well-beings of sentient beings. Those who bear these three characteristics have the Shravaka potential. And I just have a note here that could have come from Thaisa to Rinpoche, I'm not saying, is that knowing of the four truths, so the four truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the noble path to cessation of suffering, they manifestly aspire for nirvana, which is mere peace of cessation of suffering. So the level of an arhat, or this again, the truth of the cessation of suffering. And now we go back to page 11 in Ringo Toko, and now he's talking about the fourth stage, which is that of the pratyeka Buddhas, or what's often been translated as solitary realizers. So it says, they have the same qualities as the Sushravakas. They are very intelligent, but also very proud and arrogant. They give no credit to their teachers and wish to find their own path. Even if they do have a guide, or if somebody gives them good advice, their pride won't let them admit it because they want to advance by themselves. For them, Buddha has taught what is called the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha path, which leads to the state of arhat. An arhat is liberated from the sufferings of samsara, but is not yet ready to become a Buddha. Arhats are sort of foe destroyers. That's a translation of the Tibetan, the foe destroyers, who destroy their enemies, not external, but inner enemies, their own negative emotions. Having eliminated their negative emotions, they no longer experience any unhappiness because suffering arises out of negative emotions. Nevertheless, they still have some progress to make in order to become fully realized beings. And I would just like to flesh that out because there's more detail given in the Gampopa text. Again, it's page 18 if you have the hardcover book, or if you're looking at the purple jewel ornament translation, it's page 53. So in the hardcover book 18, it just says, although the above two groups, those with Shravaka potential and those with Pratyeka Buddha potential, may enter these two vehicles and attain their respective results, what they achieve is not true nirvana. And I think this goes back to a previous class when we were wondering what's the difference, you know, if there's complete nirvana and then there's a state of nirvana that's not complete. So here it's saying what they achieve is not true nirvana. At the time of their achievement, they will, on account of a latent ignorance, acquire and exist in a subtle mental body brought about by their former untainted karma. They will be convinced that the state of untainted, profound absorption they enjoy is nirvana, and that they have attained nirvana. One might object, if this is not real nirvana, it would be inappropriate for the Buddha to teach these two paths. It is, in fact, entirely appropriate for the Buddha to teach them as he did. Let us consider the following example. Some merchants from Jambuvita set out to the far-off oceans to obtain precious gems. At one point in their journey, they felt so tired and downhearted while crossing a great wilderness that they began to think they would never manage to get the jewels, and they contemplated turning back. However, through his magical powers, their leader created a great illusory citadel where they were able to rest and recuperate. Like the merchants in this story, beings of weak resolve will feel overwhelmed when they learn of the tremendous wisdom of the Buddhas, and they may feel that the task of achieving it is too daunting and far beyond the capacity of the likes of them. On account of the awe they feel, they will never undertake the task of enlightenment, or they will give up easily. By teaching the two paths of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha, the Buddha enables them to attain the refreshing, healing state of a Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha. In the Lotus Sutra, it says, likewise, all the Shravakas are under the impression that they have attained nirvana. The Buddha tells them that this is not nirvana, but a respite. When they have rested and refreshed themselves in the state of a Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha, the Buddha knows it's time to encourage them to achieve full enlightenment. And I have a note here that ties to Rinpoche, says it's not necessarily just a single Buddha, but many Buddhas at once. But in any case, how is this done? The Buddha inspires them through perfect body, speech, and mind, and wisdom mind. Light rays stream from his mind. From by these beams, merely touching their mental bodies, Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas are awakened from their untainted meditation concentration. Then the Buddha manifests his own perfect physical presence and declares the following with his pure speech: "O monks, by merely doing what you have done, the task is not accomplished and the work is not done. Your nirvana is not nirvana. Monks, now approach the Tathagata and pray heed to what he says. Understand his instruction." And then it skips down past the quotes to say, through being exhorted in this way, Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas will cultivate the great bodhicitta. Having conducted themselves as bodhisattvas for countless ages, they will become Buddhas. So that explains the level of nirvana, which is a state of mind free from suffering due to the fact that they freed themselves from their own self-clinging, and so they don't have any sense of suffering in relation to themselves, but they have not realized the emptiness of others, and so they have not developed any compassion for others' suffering, and they are just in a state of samadhi, which is, you know, in their minds, nirvana, because it's completely free of suffering. And it also mentions that they're like mental bodies, which I found interesting. And now we're up to the fifth and final of the categories or groups. And it says, still in page 19 of this text, just because it's the bold text, it says, the synopsis for those with Mahayana potential is the following. Mahayana potential is summed up through six topics: its categories, their essential characteristics, its synonyms, the reasons it is particularly outstanding, the forms it takes, and its signs. And now we return to Ringo Toku, and we're on page 11, the last paragraph. And it says, the fifth and highest stage is that of the bodhisattvas. And so here he's going to be talking about the first of these six topics, which is categories and their characteristics. And he says, here we can distinguish two different aspects regarding the potential of bodhisattvas: the potential that exists naturally and the potential that is acquired. We are referring here to the potential already inherent in all beings to become bodhisattvas, and then to the potential they have to develop the qualities leading to enlightenment. So now we're talking about the second one, the potential to develop the qualities. And it says, this potential is realized in those who have engaged in virtuous actions in the course of their past lives. When we speak about the family of bodhisattvas, we're usually referring to this category. We can say that those in whom the qualities of wisdom and compassion are apparent belong to this family of bodhisattvas. According to Gampopa, there are two types of bodhisattvas: those who are evolved thanks to their positive actions and efforts in previous lives, in whom the characteristics are apparent, and those who are not, in whom the characteristics are latent. The latter have all the qualities of a bodhisattva, but still remain under the influence of hindrances and negative emotions. These hindrances or obstacles can, however, be overcome if the person concerned works at it. Whatever the case, the characteristics of a bodhisattva can be more visible at certain times than at others. And this is, I guess, going back to Churjan's wishy-washy concept. And so we'll just finish up now by returning to, I have us at the hardcover copy of Ornament of Precious Liberation, page 20, or if you have the purple copy of this jewel ornament, it's page 53, just to speak to the final groups, because he leaves these out, Ringo Toku. So it says on page 20 in bold, it says the synonyms, so for this are potential, seed, element, and essential nature. And I look that up, and on page 298 of this book, because it's a footnote, It just says 298, so it's 23. It says, the synonyms are very helpful in understanding the connotations of Rick, the Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit term. It is potential. It is a potential one is born with, if that term is seen through its meaning of family, remembering that caste and profession were so closely linked to birth family. This is in India. It is like a seed containing from the outset the genetic information of its fruit. It is like the one prime element permeating all existence and is the essential nature of all things once the veil of illusions has fallen. And back to page 20, we're on to the fourth, which is the reasons. And it says, the reasons it stands far above. So again, this is talking about Mahayana, about the Mahayana potential. Why is it considered above? It says, it's above the other forms of potential for these reasons. The Shravaka and Pratyeka potentials are lesser ones because to realize them, only the afflictions need to be eliminated. The Mahayana potential is outstanding because its total realization involves eliminating both obscurations. This makes the Mahayana potential peerless, better than all the others. And to find out what those two obscurations are, I went to this form of this of the translation, page 54. And it says, for 54, it says, it's superior. It says, the hearer and solitary realizer families are inferior by virtue of the fact that they fully purify their families by dispelling only the obscuration of afflicting emotions. The Mahayana is superior because it fully purifies its family by dispelling two obscurations, afflicting emotions and the subtle obscurations to enlightenment. So these are the obscurations to knowledge. And it says, is that correct?
That's it. Obscuration.
Okay. Therefore, the Mahayana family is superior and unsurpassed. And then back again to where he talks about the different forms of Mahayana potential. Are it's activated? Okay, so I'm back on page 20 in the hard copy. It says, the different forms of Mahayana potential are its activated and dormant state. When the potential has been activated, its signs are manifest and the results have been properly attained. While it's dormant, the signs are not manifest and the results have not been properly attained. What activates the potential? Freedom from adverse conditions and the support of favorable ones activate it. When these are not around, it remains dormant. And I'm just going to transfer over to this one because translation because it seemed a little clearer to me for when it says what the four adverse conditions are. So on page 54 where it talks about causal characteristics, it says the causal characteristics of the family are described instead of saying active or activated and dormant, he says, or they say, they're awakened and unawakened. The awakened family has achieved the fruit perfectly and the signs are very obvious. The unawakened family has not achieved the fruit perfectly, and its mark is not obvious. What would cause this family to awaken? This family can awaken through freedom from unfavorable contributory causes and through the support of favorable conditions. If the opposite occurs, they cannot awaken. There are four unfavorable conditions: being born in unfavorable circumstances, and we know that from the eight, the unfavorable states in the first of the four thoughts that turn the mind, having no habitual tendency toward enlightenment, entering into wrong conditions, and being heavily shrouded by obscurations. There are two favorable conditions, the outer condition of a teacher and the inner condition of a mind with the proper desire for the precious Dharma, and so forth. And now we're going to finish up by just going back again to the hard copy 20, page 20, where it talks about the signs. And it says, the signs or evidence of this potential are found in the Ten Dharmas Sutra, where it describes the indications of its presence. Just as one infers the presence of fire through smoke and that of water through the presence of waterfowl, Likewise, the potential of the Bodhisattva mentality is detected by means of its signs. What are these signs? Naturally and without contrivance, such beings are peaceful in what they do and say. Their minds have little deceit or hypocrisy, and they are loving and joyful in their relations with others. As it says in the Dharmas, in the Ten Dharma Sutras, never rough or rude, beyond deceit and hypocrisy, and full of love for all beings, they are the Bodhisattvas. Further, they engender compassion toward all beings before entering into any activity. Generally aspiring to Mahayana Dharma, they undertake difficult tasks with forbearance that is never discouraged by the enormity of the undertaking, and they practice most properly and excellently that which generates virtue and has the natures of the perfections. So skip down to now where it just says, the above means that of the five types of potentials, the Mahayana one is the most direct cause for Buddhahood. The Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha potentials are also causes for attaining Buddhahood, but remoter ones. The undetermined potential is sometimes a direct cause, sometimes a remote cause. And the severed potential is considered a very remote cause, but not a total breach of the possibility of enlightenment. It is therefore an exceedingly far removed cause for it. Thus we have seen that due to having one or another of these types of potentials, sentient beings possess Buddha nature, and this has also been demonstrated through the three reasons. The actual way they possess it can be exemplified by the way silver is present in silver ore, the way sesame oil is present in sesame, or the way butter is present in milk. Just as it is possible to obtain the silver that is in ore, the oil that is in sesame seeds, and the butter that is in milk, so is it possible to attain the Buddhahood that is in all sentient beings. And I'm just returning to page 12 in Rinpo Tōpō's text, the very last paragraph. It says, all living beings have these qualities latent within them. Through work and practice, all of us can succeed in developing into and becoming Buddhas. There is no reason to think that the sufferings of samsara are inevitable or that we have to accept them as such. If we are suffering, we can do something about it. All our sufferings, all our neuroses are merely temporary and can be totally eliminated. Even when we are in the grip of confusion and undergoing great sufferings, there is no need to fall prey to frustration and despair. There is hope. It is not necessary to wait until the next life to change from one family or stage to another. In Buddhist philosophy, this life is not some static state in which we live before passing on to the next. Moving from this life to the next is simply one change in the midst of constant changes. What we call the next life then is merely a continuation of this process of change. Change is possible every single second, since change occurs every single second. It's not necessary to wait until the next life in order to transform oneself. Indeed, if we don't decide to take full responsibility for improving our future lives, there is often very little change in our general status from one life to the next. According to Buddhism, what we do now creates the following moment, which creates the one after that. In the same way, the moment of our death creates the next moment, which in this case is our next life.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
That's the Buddha nature. So thank you so much, Lama Jinzong. And for next week, I will send an email, and I'm also going to put notes on the website. Eventually, I'm going to get all of this up on the website for all the sort of take-home points. But for next week, we'll be doing the precious human existence, which is the second prerequisite, the support or the basis for attaining Buddhahood. So please read that chapter at least in Rinpo Tulku. That always comes first. That's the main text we're going to work with. And if you have time and inclination, read also Gampopa. Do you have anything else to add, Lama Jinzong, before you lead us in the dedication?
I think unless anyone has any questions, I know you already had questions and answers during the, which I missed. And again, apologize, that was unplanned. Unless anyone has any questions or thoughts, I think we can finish up. Oh, yes, please, just Joanne.
She's unmuted.
I want to thank both Lama Troden and yourself for aligning both the commentary and the teaching seamlessly. It was highly beneficial.
And that was Imogen Song.
It's very positive. Thank you.
Oh, good. Good. Okay, the one question I have actually regarding the final dedication prayer, if I may, because there's no one else who has any thoughts, is that children, where it says dedicated of merit, it says they know things in their true existence.
Yeah.
I have written here, I dedicate all virtue fully, and you seem to say, I dedicate this practice fully.
Yeah, that's an updated translation. I'll send you the update.
So should I say this practice fully?
I don't think it matters. That's what I say, this practice. I think most people have that version.
Of this practice?
Yeah, I dedicate this practice fully.
Okay, so I'll do that. So
we can all make that mental adjustment, though.
If I say it differently. Anyway, thank you again for your patience. I'm sorry if it was in any way disruptive. Sorry.
It was excellent practice.
Okay, then. Good. Okay, so here we go. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu Zampo and Manjushri, to train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies, and that merit and wisdom emanate the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication, please fulfill.
Okay, since we're over.